The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We are sure you'll agree it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. Joining me from fabled Goldcorn Holler in Nashville, Tennessee, is Jeremy Goldcorn, a man who stands with Hong Kong, but who also stands with Xi Jinping, who's a great guy, a great guy, a great leader. Jeremy, greet the people.
Another ridiculous one. Thank you, Kaiser. I'm joined today in my home studio by my daughter's hamster, Niblet. Niblet, welcome to Seneca.
Yes, indeed. Niblet, welcome to the show. Over the weekend, a cache of documents offering details into the operations of China's so-called re-education camps in Xinjiang was released by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ. The release included full English translations of the documents, which included a secret long telegram, along with four shorter bulletins about a truly disturbing algorithmic system for determining the list of detainees, and a non-classified court document. The lead reporter on all this was Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, who has worked as a journalist for several organizations, including Foreign Policy and the Daily Beast, and is now at Axios. Bethany joins us today from Washington to talk about these releases. Bethany, welcome to Seneca.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Bethany, you were recently denied a journalist visa to China. After this, I guess you can kiss that J visa goodbye for quite some time, right?
Yes, I think that is safe to say. I also don't feel like it would probably be a good idea, even for my own safety or the safety of my family, to try to go to China at this time. I've been handling classified Chinese government documents, and I think they frown upon that. So, no, I'm not going to be trying to do that anytime soon.
If I was your mother, I would certainly give you that advice. But seriously, congratulations on this major journalistic accomplishment, and also for the good that it will hopefully do for the detainees and for the Uyghurs more generally. Let's begin with what is in the leak. What did we learn from this trove of documents? Or did we already know the substance of the abuses and atrocities, but this leak provided evidence and details of the process? Let's not get too much into the weeds, but could you give us a brief, big picture description of the contents of the leak and your reporting?
Sure. What these documents do is show, in the government's own words, that when they say that these camps are vocational training centers that are essentially benevolent social services, that's essentially a lie. There are statements within the operations manual that we obtained that include statements like never allow escapes and never allow abnormal deaths. Those are not normal things for a government to say about its own programs. What that tells us is that people were not here of their own volition, that the conditions in the camps were very bad, and that the government knew that by putting people in these facilities, they were putting human lives at risk. The second cache of documents that we got were classified intelligence briefings that give a vast amount of new detail about how China operates what, you know, you could call an arrest by algorithm kind of platform. Lots of brand new details that gives us a lot more knowledge about how that works. And the third document that you received was a Uyghur language court case that shows, I would say, the tragedy of what happened to one individual Uyghur man who was sentenced to 10 years in prison for advocating very normal tenets of the Islamic faith.
That's great. Perfect. We're going to get into all three of these document types. But first, tell us what you're able to about the actual origins of these leaked documents. Do you know who they were originally written for?
Yes. So the operations manual was approved by Zhu Hailun, who at the time was the deputy party secretary of Xinjiang and also served as the secretary of the Xinjiang Political and Legal Affairs Commission. And that's the party commission that is in charge of security in the region and has also been in charge of implementing the camps. So he was Chen Quanguo's right-hand man and is also basically in charge of implementing the policy of the camps. He wrote this and it was, we believe, disseminated to the cadres and other kinds of security officials who were responsible for running the camps. The second cache of documents, the classified intelligence briefings, were in fact hand-signed by Zhu Hailun himself. We verified his handwritten signature. And those were also disseminated to the same, you know, the local party secretaries and other officials in charge of security on the local levels. And that was through a committee, a party committee with a long name, but basically the committee that is responsible for implementing the Strike Hard campaign.
Right, the Yenda,
yes.
Right, Strike Hard.
Yes.
So just to quickly ID Chen Quanguo, for those of you who don't know who he is, the listeners out there who might not know, he is the Xinjiang Autonomous Region's provincial, the party secretary, basically the top party dog in Xinjiang, and he used to be in charge of Tibet.
Bethany, what can you tell us about the individual or individuals who provided the documents or how they were acquired? And, you know, were they the result of a hack or a whistleblower? Or what can you inform us as to the origin of these leaks?
Sure. This was not a hack. This was a leak. Obviously, the provenance of the documents is extraordinarily sensitive. But what I can say is that they came to ICIJ through a verified chain of transmission via Uyghurs outside of China.
Okay. So about the provenance, your lead piece on the leaked docs cites James Mulvin, and who's a very highly regarded expert, especially on national security and tech when it comes to China. And he vouched for the authenticity of the documents. Can you talk about what it was that had James convinced? Were there other experts maybe who you also brought in who confirmed their authenticity?
Yes, we spoke with many experts and did many kinds of authentication work to make sure these documents were authentic. Mm. James, you know, part of what he does professionally is to authenticate classified Chinese government documents.
Right.
And when he looked at them, he said that they conform 100% to every template of a classified Chinese document that he has ever seen. He explained that Chinese government documents follow a very regimented kind of format in terms of their font, you know, how they do bullet points, their, you know, what parts are bold, what kind of introductory language they use, where the, you know, where the chops appear, you know, the numbers that are, you know, the identifying numbers, all kinds of things like that. And he said that this conforms to those kinds of templates 100%. Other experts, including Adrian Zenz, have done their own careful authentication involving a language analysis, and we also did our own in-house language analysis on the documents, comparing the slogans and other phrases that were used in these documents with slogans and phrases that appeared in public-facing Chinese government statements and publications around the same time to see if there was a match. And indeed, there was a very close match. And we also traced Zhu Hailun's travels around Xinjiang, and in June 2017, when all of the classified intelligence briefings that we received were disseminated, he had just that month he was doing kind of a, you know, what do you want to call it, like a field research trip, you know, around Xinjiang that corroborated some of the stuff in those documents. So we, you know, feel just absolutely confident in saying that these documents are authentic.
Great. This is the second batch of leaks that we've seen in just a matter of days, though obviously they were provided much earlier. They needed to be vetted, they needed to be translated and whatnot. How would you contrast the significance of this batch of documents with the earlier batch that came from the New York Times? And maybe what's the larger significance taken together of all these leaks? Do they maybe suggest that there's growing opposition within China to Xi Jinping or to this policy of incarceration, of mass extralegal detention in Xinjiang?
I think that the release of these two batches of documents are highly complementary.
Right.
So if you look at the New York Times leaks, you know, it starts much earlier than our documents. It starts in 2014, and you have a collection of speeches from Xi Jinping. And what it really does, and what I really loved about those leaks, is that it answers for me what has been an incredibly important question, which is, did Xi Jinping himself want this? Who did this come from? You know, and it answered that question for us. It also gave us a lot of insight into the conceptual origins of these camps. Again, an incredibly important contribution to our understanding of where they came from and how the Chinese government views their role and, you know, their purpose for existence.
Right.
And our documents essentially, I would say, pick up where the New York Times left off. You know, we have, for the very first time, the Chinese government's own internal classified words and details about how the camps are supposed to be run and how they are being run. And we have incredibly detailed information about how IJOP, the Integrated Joint Operations Platform, how it has collected information, what information it collects, how it analyzes that, and how police around the region use that analysis to detain tens of thousands of people at a time based on essentially, you know, complex and unknown algorithms. And that's stuff that wasn't known before. Together, I would say, if you look at these leaks together, what they show... Well, first, you know, it's important to understand that the last time, to my knowledge, there were classified government document leaks were the Tiananmen papers in 2001. I mean, it's exceedingly rare for this to happen. And that's not a coincidence. That's not an accident, right? It's because people who leak classified government documents, you know, they know that the Chinese government will kill them and perhaps kill their family members. So they're taking a huge, huge risk, and that is really effective in stopping leaks. So what we're seeing now is, you know, with the Tiananmen papers, that reflected a period of crisis, domestic, political, and social crisis, a self-inflicted existential crisis in China. I think the fact that there have now been a succession of leaks indicates that there is another domestic, political, and social self-inflicted crisis in China right now, and people know it.
Fascinating, yeah.
Bethany, let's look first into some detail at the longest of the documents in this batch, the so-called telegram.
Yeah.
It goes into quite a bit of operational detail.
Yes.
Can you sketch out for us what sorts of issues it addresses?
Well, the first section in that operations manual, as we are calling it, is a section on security. And again, this, you know, essentially refutes the Chinese government's implication. They haven't said it necessarily directly, but the implication that these facilities are voluntary, or at least that they're pleasant. So, you know, we see a directive to prevent escapes. We see a directive that the guards should undergo combat training, that there should be guard towers and patrols, that inmates should live an extremely regimented life for the sake of security. And it actually calls for specifically the secure management of toilet breaks to prevent escape. So it's you get a sense of this intense, you know, prison-style, military-style life that people live, that, you know, from the time they get up in the morning to where they sit, to where they sleep, to you know, when they use the restroom, to where they stand in line, is all being dictated to them for the purposes of security.
Even the position they sleep in.
Yeah, it's really quite stunning. And I did already mention earlier this line that's I would say chilling, that, you know, never allow abnormal deaths. Now, that's better than allow abnormal deaths. Right. But what that indicates is that, you know, the people planning this and Zhu Hailun himself knew that they were putting people into a situation where abnormal deaths, whatever they mean by that, could occur. And they're telling people to stop it. That's really scary.
Right. I mean, I imagine that means just deaths from beatings or from torture or from suicide or anything like that.
Yeah. That's right. I am assuming that is what that means, yes.
This is great, though. The document comes from 2017, and before that, many people outside of China were not even vaguely aware of this planned program. But between the New York Times leaks and these ICIJ leaks, we know quite a bit now about the actual timeline of how things were planned, when the facilities were built, when the first detainees were interred, and so forth. Can you quickly sketch that out for us? What do we know now about the timeline of these things?
Well, we know that the rise of the global rise of the Islamic State weighed very heavily on the minds of Chinese government officials. And you can date that, you know, to 2014, 2015. And that's certainly what we see. That's not to say that, you know, these camps are the result of, you know, global terrorism, and they are most certainly not a reasonable policy result from that, because, you know, the threat of religious extremism among Uyghurs is very, very small. So you have, you know, these discussions starting in 2014. I believe it was 2013, the fall of 2013, when you had the first, I think it is fair to say this was a terrorist attack that happened outside of Xinjiang, and that was actually at Tiananmen Square in Beijing, when there was a few Uyghurs who were driving a car, and they mowed down some civilians, some tourists or some pedestrians, and killed them. And that was, I think, terribly alarming to Chinese officials. And so you see, you know, not long after that, the launch of the Strike Hard campaign and increasing restrictions on Uyghur Islamic practice, on Uyghur identity, on language, on bilingual education, and just a growing kind of security, construction of a surveillance and security state in Xinjiang.
Right. There was also the attack in the train station in Kunming.
Ah,
well.
Yes. That was 2015, right? That was April. Yeah, I believe April 2015. And
actually, it was March 2014.
Some people in China have called that China's 9/11. I think that's a gross exaggeration. I believe it was 31 people who died, 41, right around there. That's obviously horrendous, and I don't mean to discount those deaths. And that was a great tragedy. And that was committed by nine, I think they were all Uyghurs, with knives at a train station in Kunming. Again, just terribly alarming and shocking, really, for all of China, and that is understandable. But the reaction to that has caused great, you know, far more harm than that attack did. So then by 2016, you know, the discussions of this, the idea of creating mass facilities, you know, to basically re-engineer the minds of an entire ethnic minority population, this idea has already, it already exists in the minds of local officials. And so in 2016, you start to see moves towards that direction. And late 2016, early 2017 is when you start to see the actual construction of camps, and by mid 2017 they're in full swing. And by November 2017, when the operations manual was disseminated, you get the sense, first of all, that they had a very clear idea of the scale at which they were operating. There is some lines in the manual about, you know, for facilities, you know, for training centers with more than 1,000 residents, be sure that you have food sanitation workers to prevent, you know, food safety or foodborne illness outbreaks or things like that. So they have a sense of the scale. But even more alarmingly and interestingly, near the end of it, there is a directive for every local level, all the local governments, to that you must, you know, commit part of your budgets towards the building of these facilities. So you get the sense that they're basically detaining people faster than they can house them.
Bethany, what can you tell us about the Integrated Joint Operations Platform? We've heard about it beginning last year when Maya Wang at Human Rights Watch wrote about it, but these leaks seem to confirm the worst techno-authoritarian nightmare scenarios that people have worried about when it comes to Xinjiang, a kind of deeply flawed pre-crime predictive tech straight out of that Tom Cruise movie Minority Report.
That's exactly right. I'm so sad to say that I don't think that that is an exaggeration. Mm. And having spent so much time looking at these at the classified bulletins, it's really I would say that it's so chilling and shocking. And there's one in particular that I had to read it several times as it kind of sunk in what was happening. So it's bulletin number, I believe it's number 14, maybe number 9. I'd have to go back and check. I think it's 14, where it starts out by saying, you know, in the period from June 19th to June 26th, 2017, IJOP produced 24,412 names, and then it breaks down all the different locations there that those people are in Xinjiang, and it says, and in that week, you know, the local police, you know, located, investigated, and detained 15,000, some number, more than 15,000 of them, and then an additional 700 or so were criminally detained. The end. You know, just very, very brief, very concise.
Matter of fact, yeah.
I would say machine-like and cold.
Right, right.
Those are 15,000 lives that have just been shattered because of an algorithm. And we don't even know from this particular bulletin, what that, you know, what were the criteria? We don't even know. And the rest of the bulletin is spent not, you know, asking, well, how do we know they're guilty? Maybe we should, you know, how do we know our algorithm is effective or good? No, it was spent analyzing why they weren't able to detain even more people, because the system had produced 24,000 names and they were only able to detain 15,000. What we don't know is, was this happening every week? Because we only got a snapshot. We only got, a limited number of bulletins.
Right.
Is there a bulletin being produced every day? Is this happening every week? I don't know. You know, the sense you get is just this, a total removal of the humanity of the people who are being affected by this.
Bethany, do these new leaks reveal anything specific about the AI tech that's actually being used? Or is just the sort of enormousness of the database its key feature?
It does not reveal anything on the technical side of how it operates. Mm. What you see is more the result. You know, I would say I got a sense, and this is not made explicit, but it is the sense that I got, that IJOP, so it's very much a two-way street in terms of information. So information is fed into IJOP, and Maya Wang's report did an excellent job showing how police have this app on their phone that connects to IJOP. And they enter in information that way. But there's all these other kinds of information that go into it too. For example, there was one bulletin that talked about an app called Zapya, which is similar to AirDrop. And it's funded in part through a Silicon Valley partner that's a Chinese company. And, you know, it's very common and very widespread use in China.
Right.
In Xinjiang, there were... Yeah, it's a normal app. It's nothing nefarious. In Xinjiang, there were 1.8 million users of this app, and they somehow got hold of all that data of the users. I do not know how they did that. And they put that into IJOP and then had IJOP analyze all those people for other signs that they deemed suspicious. For example, whether or not they had gone on the Hajj, which is one of the five basic tenets.
Pillars of Islam. Yeah.
That's right. And those people were flagged for investigation and, you know, vocational training.
Let me ask you a little bit about Zapya. Yeah. I mean, it's called Kuaiya in Chinese, and the document
refers
to it as Kuaiya, just so people are clear.
Right.
This allows you to move files, but my understanding was it was being used to move a lot of Quranic passages. Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course, but it was interesting that Darren Byler, who you talked to for this and who's a columnist for us, he talks about how this app was supposed to provide space for religious and cultural expression, but that it instead became evidence of supposed religious extremism. There's something just really quite grotesque about that, huh?
It is. I'm a huge fan of Darren Byler's work, and I think that he's exactly right. And it's very interesting because Zapier, in fact, has sort of promoted or marketed itself as being very friendly to Islamic users, and you know, apparently that worked. People were using it to transmit videos and things. In the document, in the bulletin, this is the only place in all of the documents that mentions extremist organizations and the Islamic State. So they took these 1.8 million users and fed it through IJOP to check if anyone had joined terrorist organizations such as the Islamic State. Now, I don't know how IJOP would have that information. I don't know. But that was one of the things they were checking for.
Bethany, can you tell us about the point system that's being used inside the caps that's detailed in the manual?
Yeah, this is something that, you know, the documents reveal for the first time the details about this point system. So every inmate has like a score associated with them, and that is determined by their test scores on their Chinese language exams and on the exams that check their knowledge of Chinese communist ideology, and also on their behavior, although we're not sure exactly what behavior that is. And so, you know, these points are used to determine rewards and punishments, including when or whether or not they're allowed to see their family or have phone calls with their family. And also, it plays into part of the decision on when they're able to be released. And so you have what is essentially like the world's most high-stakes testing, this environment that is such high pressure. They're in terrible conditions. They're away from their family. They don't know their future. And now they have to perform on these exams. But basically, what you have in the camps is a system that puts inmates under psychological torture and constant pressure.
Bethany, one of the bulletins focuses on a particular behavior that seemed to get people flagged, and that was opening online accounts, user accounts on particular internet services, opening them and then deleting them using the same national ID card.
Yeah.
Can you explain why that would arouse suspicion?
We're not fully clear on that. Let me just be clear that I'm speculating here. I think that perhaps the logic behind that is if someone is trying to avoid detection, you know, so and it's actually not clear what kind of accounts were referred to. It says open and close accounts three times. It's actually unclear what kind of accounts it's referring to. It could be maybe cell phone accounts or internet accounts or something. The idea is like perhaps this person was trying to avoid detection.
Right.
You know, they were using burner phones or unclear. But something like that, I think, was what they had in mind. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's what I would have guessed.
So, Bethany, can we talk about the court document that was included in the leaks? What seems to be very interesting here is the apparently very low threshold of behavior that this individual, the accused, whose identity is protected in the leaked document, the very low threshold of behavior that he engaged by him to land him behind bars for assembling a crowd to disturb the social order. Or was it his use of the word kafir or kufr, you know, the infidel? What was it?
Was he like, you know, like insulting Han Chinese people, or what was the deal?
Yeah, I think that's very astute that you caught that. I would actually say that, what he was actually sentenced or like found guilty of was inciting ethnic hatred and ethnic discrimination. And it lists several kinds of behaviors that his coworkers testified, I don't know if they were, if it was under coercion or not, about what he told them. And some of it was like, don't watch porn, you know, be sure and pray, things like that, very normal sort of Islamic things. But there's this one line where he says, you know, don't, I forget exactly what it is, don't do this thing, or else you will be like the Han Chinese kafirs. And that's just a word that means non-believer.
Infidels. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, basically he's just like, you know, this is haram, that's haram.
Yes, I would prefer, if you don't mind, to translate that as non-believer, because infidel has this sort of meaning of like, let's go kill the infidel in the jihad. But actually kafir is just a very normal word. It's like Gentile. So it's not, it's, you know, in an Islamic context, and this is in an Islamic context, it's just saying don't be like the unbelievers.
Right.
However, I think the use of Han Chinese kafirs is perhaps what drove that that charge of inciting ethnic hatred and ethnic discrimination. So I want to talk, if I can, just briefly about like the nature of religion and of Islamic practice in Xinjiang and its role there kind of socially. You know, Muslims in China are a very tiny minority, and among Hui Muslims, which is a different ethnic minority, and in fact, the only reason that they're an ethnic group at all is because they're Muslim. And over the centuries, they found that was the thing that bound them together as an ethnic group. Now, Uyghurs aren't the same exactly. They've always had their own language, for example. But it's certainly the case that people there hold tight to religion as something that helps keep them distinct, you know, in a country in which they're a tiny minority. There's nothing wrong with that, to view religion as a part of your identity that sets you apart from others. However, the Chinese Communist Party, under Xi Jinping especially, has grown ever more suspicious of any kind of loyalty that could supersede the Communist Party, whether that's to a religion or an ethnicity or an ideology, such as a belief in democracy, for example. And it is my understanding that what you're seeing in this document is not the result of any kind of actual, you know, he was calling for some kind of jihad on the Han Chinese, but rather a fear and a, you know, this fear on the part of the party of anything that could command the loyalties of Chinese, of people in China.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One thing that I noticed about this guy is that he seems to be very young. I mean, his status as an adult at the time of his committing the alleged crime was so not obvious that they felt like they needed to include his date of birth specifically to show that he wasn't still a minor at the time.
So can you remind me of the year of his birth?
It doesn't say. They left it out. They left the year of his birth out. I think it was good because they wanted to leave identifying
information. Oh, we redacted it. Yes. I'm glad I didn't just spout that then. Yes, we redacted that.
Okay, I'm glad you did. So it's clear that he was, you know, close enough to the sort of the border of, you know, 18 or whatever at the time, that he, you know, they wanted to make clear that he wasn't a minor. So I'm curious though, does the IJOP or do the Xinjiang authorities target younger Uyghurs in particular, or do they seem pretty agnostic when it comes to age? And what about gender or any other sort of demographic information about who they're targeting?
So I would be drawing on Adrian Zenz's work and this, and he really is the person to ask about that. Very recently published a study of the demographics of people in the camps. But my understanding is that it leans very heavily male, that being, a male of, a sort of young to middle-aged male is automatically kind of a strike against you.
Yeah.
If you're a Uyghur in Xinjiang.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine that's the case.
One thing that James Mulvenin said about IJOP that struck me as very important is that what's happening in Xinjiang is just in terms of this sort of predictive policing, arrest by algorithm kind of model, that is only a small part of what IJOP does. James referred to it as a big cybernetic brain that is a physical thing, a large physical actual thing that is in Beijing. And what it does is, you know, it they're trying to use, the Chinese government is trying to use artificial intelligence to help generate a superior military strategy, superior policing strategy. And, you know, what James emphasized is that they're essentially trying to use that in some cases to replace human cognition, and that can result in very, very serious miscarriages of justice and even catastrophe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think that what we're seeing in Xinjiang is just sort of an example of that.
Mm. Yeah, it would certainly appear that way. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Bethany, you live in Washington, D.C., a town that is obsessed with Donald Trump, court intrigue, partisan fighting, and impeachment.
Yeah.
Is this leak and your team's reporting around it going to break through the noise in D.C.? And if it does, and I may add a second question, what can and should the United States do aside from applying Magnitsky sanctions and the listing of tech companies on the entity list? What should we do about Xinjiang?
Yeah. I would say that the way that, you know, without commenting on timing, as it so happened, the way that these leaks came out last week with the New York Times and this week with ours, it's kind of been a 1-2 punch. And I'm just saying that from a, you know, sort of in hindsight, watching how it's played out, that because it happened all at once like that, it's kind of created a narrative about this. People are curious about why all these leaks right now. What does it mean? And in that way, it does seem to have at least broken this through the surface a little bit. There's, you know, we've gotten a huge amount of media interest, even from, I mean, countries around the world. I've had media requests from probably 8 different countries so far. So there is a lot of interest. However, you know the speed of our news cycle, and this will be a blip the way that anything else is a blip, at least in terms of, you know, major headlines. But there will be long-lasting ramifications, I believe. Sophie Richardson has said, you know, that it seems that this, or she's kind of implied that this provides just incredible evidence for the International Criminal Court, proof, you know, in the government's own words of what they are doing in Xinjiang. And that is significant. It's my hope that in the long term, with some of these very slow moving mechanisms in government, that we could see some long term ramifications of this. In terms of what the U.S. government can do, first of all, the U.S. government has done essentially nothing so far. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has made a few strong statements. That's good. I am fine. I'm supportive of that. And, you know, recently 28 different Chinese entities from some local governments and companies were put on the entities list, which prohibits U.S. companies from exporting some products to them without prior approval from the U.S. government. That is essentially symbolic. That's not going to have any serious side effects on people. So far, basically, there's been a couple of very minor symbolic steps taken, you know, the passage or the, you know, people supporting the Uyghur Human Rights Act. Symbolic things are important and they matter. Let me present what I think the international community's response should be. I mentioned the Tiananmen massacre earlier, both as a, you know, it was a huge domestic political and social crisis in China, and an international crisis, because what happened was they faced a crippling, a barrage of sanctions after that, and they became at least temporarily a pariah in the international community. It is my strong opinion and informed opinion that China should face those exact same set of punitive sanctions, and that they should become a pariah in the international community because of what they are doing in Xinjiang. However, they will not, because, you know, our geopolitical situation in our world today is vastly different, and they have an incredible amount of economic power and leverage, much more diplomatic power and leverage than they had before, and military strength. So it's really about, you know, might makes right. And if something is wrong, but no one says so, what does that mean?
So Bethany, given those limitations, assuming that that pessimistic view is true, that there is no way that the international community would mobilize around really broad, very strongly punitive sanctions, what then should we do?
I think it is, let me be clear, it would be possible for the United States and the international community to mobilize and to do things. China is responsive to international pressure. I think that sometimes people have this sense of fatalism that there's nothing that anyone could do that would change Chinese behavior, and that is absolutely false.
That's right.
And it has been false, I would say, even with relation to the camps. For example, in the operations manual, the final section there was a section about maintaining absolute secrecy.
Yeah, they clearly fear exposure, yeah.
Yeah, they feared exposure. And they still do. They still fear it. You know what's happening right now inside the party is, you know, it's bad times right now. Like, you know, you just know that there's a ton of pressure, a ton of fear, you know, finger pointing. This is not good for them, certainly. And there are things that can be done. For example, and this would be basic bare minimum, back a few years ago, the U.S. Implemented the Global Magnitsky Act, which allows the U.S., you know, provides a very clear mechanism for the U.S. to implement sanctions on key individuals in foreign governments who are complicit in human rights violations. And the Trump administration has shown themselves to be very willing to use the Global Magnitsky Act. They levied sanctions under that act on several cabinet-level Turkish officials when Turkey was detaining an American Christian pastor. They could so easily implement those kinds of sanctions on Chen Quanguo, Zhu Hailun, even Xi Jinping himself. And there has, you know, in fact, we know that there was a list that has been researched and created, you know, within the U.S. government specifically to do that. However, that has been held up. It is my understanding it's been held up because of the trade negotiations. So, I mean, and that even that would be symbolic. You know, the U.S. could implement many other kinds of sanctions. It could pressure. I'm not an expert on policy. I'm a journalist. You know, but
right.
There are many measures that the government could take, and they are not taking because I think a lot of the attention and the will of the government is currently directed in different directions, and I don't even need to mention the fact that, you know, the current U.S. president is not interested in supporting democratic values or human rights, and certainly is not willing to give up his trade deal for something like that.
That's right.
Bethany, before we go, you've done a lot of interviews about this amazing work. Is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't asked you or that you haven't been asked before?
I would like to add that, you know, China is by no means the only country that is guilty of committing, you know, mass human rights violations. For example, Myanmar, you know, had a campaign of ethnic cleansing against the Rohingya. But what's different about the camps in Xinjiang and the mass surveillance there, and why everyone in the world should care, and why this relates to everyone, is that, you know, no one looks to Myanmar as a model of governance. Many countries look to China as a model of governance. And in fact, China, the Chinese Communist Party promotes that. And not just, you know, sort of generally, but they have specifically promoted this specific policy of camps as a good way to implement, you know, counterterrorism. They have said this should be a model. So, you know, this shows that this what's happening in Xinjiang is not staying in Xinjiang and will not stay in Xinjiang. And that's even more true of IJOP and of the mass surveillance and data collection regime that we are seeing there. You know, companies like Huawei, And through, you know, through Chinese government initiatives like Safe Cities, they are actively exporting the idea and the actual technology to blanket entire populations in this kind of surveillance. These are already under, you know, these kinds of, the Safe City thing is already under construction in places like Pakistan. So this has very profound implications for human rights all over the world, not just in China.
Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about this really important work. I know you have had a punishing interview schedule. Meanwhile, let's move on to recommendations. But first, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca and the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best way you can support our work is to subscribe to SupChina's daily newsletter. This thing is just chock full of great reads on China delivered to your inbox every weekday. Jeremy, Lucas, and Jiayun work very hard to bring you this tremendously useful product, and it's just great value for money. So sign up, spread the word. I also want to make sure you're all subscribed to our latest podcast, Strangers in China. Okay, on to recommendations. Jeremy, as is our tradition, you may go first.
This I have recommended before on the show, but I want to do it again because of the content of this particular show, which is the book One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps by Andrea Pitzer. I've now read it twice, and it's really worthwhile if you're thinking about Xinjiang, because I guess in some ways there are certain inevitable awful things that happen when you put a bunch of people in a concentrated space together to achieve some kind of cultural or social engineering aim, and it's not good, but it's a very powerful and well-written and researched book.
Great. Well, you've read it twice, so it's fair that you recommend it twice. Bethany, what do you have for us?
Well, I'm maybe along similar lines, I'm currently reading The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt.
Yes.
And I've only just started it, so I cannot give, you know, a very pithy summary of the book, but she does a good, an incredible, brilliant job of laying out what totalitarianism has looked like in the 20th century, with very strong implications for our world today. And I chose to start reading that book because I feel like we are at a turning point in our understanding, or we're in a turning point of what China is becoming. And I have very much felt at a loss over the past few months, especially. I don't have the vocabulary that I feel that I need to talk about what China is becoming now. I think it's a little bit difficult to simply categorize. And so I've been doing a lot of reading about authoritarian and totalitarian systems.
I gave a talk the other night where I said very clearly that, you know, we might not be ready to apply the word totalitarianism to the totality of China, but I don't hesitate to use it for what's happening in the governance of Xinjiang. That is truly, I think, by any reasonable definition, true totalitarianism.
Yeah, I mean, I would strongly agree with that.
Mm. Well, my recommendation for this week, thanks, Bethany. That's a great one. Hannah Arendt is always worth reading. In the Chinese context, but also in the American context. And with that in mind, I recommend the December issue of The Atlantic, which is a themed issue called How to Stop a Civil War, and really ought to be read cover to cover. It's just full of terrific essays about the state of our divided nation, including some really, really provocative pieces. I would just single out a couple of them. One is called The Dark Psychology of Social Networks. Another is called Too Much Democracy is Bad for Democracy. And a third that was really, it's really got me thinking, is called The Dishonesty of the Abortion Debate. So all three of these, and really every essay in this issue, is very much worth reading, whether or not you are an American. Bethany, thank you once again for taking the time. And again, congratulations on this really, really important work of journalism for you and the whole ICIJ.
Thank you so much. It was definitely an enormous collaborative project. So I would like to thank the 17 media outlets from 14 different countries and the more than 75 journalists who also participated in this.
Well, it's great work you did. Jeremy, great to talk to you as always.
Likewise, and thank you so much, Bethany. It was a delight talking to you, even if it was about such awful subject matter.
Likewise.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at Seneca@supchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at @supchinanews. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, new voices, and Ta for Ta, and the Middle Earth podcast on the culture industry in China. Oh, and don't forget our newest family member, Strangers in China. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.